Chapter 12. When some dreaded morning comes, we usually wake fully to it at once. Ransom passed with no intermediate stages from dreamless sleep to a full consciousness of his task. He found himself alone, the island gently rocking on a sea that was neither calm nor stormy. The golden light, glinting through indigo trunks of trees, told him in which direction the water lay. He went to it and bathed. Then, having landed again, he lay down and drank. He stood for a few minutes, running his hands through his wet hair and stroking his limbs. Looking down at his own body, he noticed how greatly the sunburn on one side and the pallor on the other had decreased. He would hardly be christened piebald if the lady were now to meet him for the first time. His colour had become more like ivory, and his toes, after so many days of nakedness, had begun to lose the cramped, squalid shape imposed by boots. Altogether he thought better of himself as a human animal than he had done before. He felt pretty certain that he would never again wield an unmaimed body until a greater morning came for the whole universe, and he was glad that the instrument had been thus tuned up to concert pitch before he had to surrender it. "When I wake up after thy image, I shall be satisfied," he said to himself. Presently he walked into the woods. Accidentally, for he was at the moment intent on food, he blundered through a whole cloud of the arboreal bubbles. The pleasure was as sharp as when he had first experienced it, and his very stride was different as he emerged from them. Although this was to be his last meal, he did not even now feel it proper to look for any favourite fruit. But what met him was gourds. "A good breakfast on the morning you're hanged," he thought whimsically, as he let the empty shell drop from his hand, filled for the moment with such pleasure as seemed to make the whole world a dance. "All said and done," he thought, "it's been worth it. I have had a time. I have lived in paradise." He went a little farther in the wood, which grew thickly hereabout, and almost tripped over the sleeping form of the lady. It was unusual for her to be sleeping at this time of the day, and he assumed it was Maleldil's doing. "I shall never see her again," he thought, "and then I shall never again look on a female body in quite the same way as I look on this." As he stood looking down on her, what was most with him was an intense and orphaned longing that he might, if only for once, have seen the great mother of his own race thus, in her innocence and splendour. "Other things, other blessings, other glories," he murmured, "but never that, never in all worlds that. God can make good use of all that happens, but the loss is real." He looked at her once again, and then walked abruptly past the place where she lay. "I was right," he thought. "It couldn't have gone on. It was time to stop it." It took him a long time, wandering like this, in and out of the dark yet coloured thickets, before he found his enemy. He came on his old friend, the dragon, just as he had first seen it, coiled about the trunk of a tree. But it also was asleep. And now he noticed that ever since he awoke he had perceived no chattering of birds, no rustling of sleek bodies or peering of brown eyes through the leafage, nor heard any noise but that of water. It seemed that the Lord God had cast that whole island, or perhaps that whole world, into deep sleep. For a moment this gave him a sense of desolation, but almost at once he rejoiced that no memory of blood and rage should be left imprinted in these happy minds. After about an hour, suddenly rounding a little clump of bubble trees, he found himself face to face with the unman. "Is it wounded already?" he thought, as the first vision of a blood-stained chest broke on him. Then he saw that, of course, it was not its own blood. A bird, already half-plucked and with beak wide open in the soundless yell of strangulation, was feebly struggling in its long, clever hands. Ransom found himself acting before he knew what he had done. Some memory of boxing at his preparatory school must have awaked, for he found he had delivered a straight left with all his might on the unman's jaw. But he had forgotten that he was not fighting with gloves. What recalled him to himself was the pain as his fist crashed against the jawbone. It seemed almost to have broken his knuckles, and the sickening jar all up his arm. He stood still for a second under the shock of it, and this gave the unman time to fall back about 6 paces. It, too, had not liked the first taste of the encounter. It had apparently bitten its tongue, for blood came bubbling out of the mouth when it tried to speak. It was still holding the bird. "So you mean to try strength," it said in English, speaking thick. "Put down that bird," said Ransom. "But this is very foolish," said said the young man. "Do you not know who I am?" "I know what you are," said Ransom. "Which of them doesn't matter." "And you think, little one," it answered, "that you can fight with me? You think he will help you, perhaps? Many thought that. I've known him longer than you, little one. They all think he's going to help them, till they come to their senses, screaming recantations too late in the middle of the fire, mouldering in concentration camps, writhing under sores, gibbering in madhouses, or nailed onto crosses. Could he help himself?" And the creature suddenly threw back its head and cried in a voice so loud that it seemed the golden sky roof must break, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani!" And the moment it had done so, Ransom felt certain that the sounds it had made were perfect Aramaic of the first century. The young man was not quoting. It was remembering. These were the very words spoken from the cross, treasured through all those years in the burning memory of the outcast creature which had heard them, and now brought forward in hideous parody. The horror made him momentarily sick. Before he had recovered, the unman was upon him, howling like a gale, with eyes so wide open that they seemed to have no lids, and with all its hair rising on its scalp. It had caught him tightly to its chest, with its arms about him, and its nails were ripping great strips off his back. His own arms were inside its embrace, and, pummeling wildly, he could get no blow at it. He turned his head and bit deeply into the muscle of its right arm, at first without success, then deeper. It gave a howl, tried to hold on, and then suddenly he was free. Its defense was, for an instant, unready, and he found himself raining punches about the region of its heart faster and harder than he had supposed possible. He could hear through its open mouth the great gusts of breath that he was knocking out of it. Then its hands came up again, fingers arched like claws. It was not trying to box. It wanted to grapple. He knocked its right arm aside with a horrible shock of bone against bone and caught it a jab on the fleshy part of the chin. At the same moment, its nails tore his right. He grabbed at its arms. More by luck than by skill, he got it held by both wrists. What followed for the next minute or so would hardly have looked like a fight at all to any spectator. The unman was trying with every ounce of power it could find in Weston's body to wrench its arms free from Ransom's hands, and he, with every ounce of his power, was trying to retain his manacle hold round its wrists. But this effort, which sent streams of sweat down the backs of both combatants, resulted in a slow and seemingly leisurely and even aimless movement of both pairs of arms. Neither could, for the moment, hurt the other. The unman bent forward its head and tried to bite, but Ransom straightened his arms and kept it at arm's length. There seemed no reason why this should ever end. Then suddenly it shot out its leg and crooked it behind his knee. He was nearly taken off his feet. Movements became quick and flurried on both sides. Ransom, in his turn, tried to trip and failed. He started bending the enemy's left arm by main force, with some idea of breaking, or at least spraining it. But in the effort to do so, he must have weakened his hold on the other wrist. It got its right free. He had just time to close his eyes before the nails tore fiercely down his cheek and the pain put an end to the blows his left was already raining on its ribs. A second later, he did not know quite how it happened, they were standing apart, their chests heaving in great gasps, each staring at the other. Both were doubtless sorry spectacles. Ransom could not see his own wounds, but he seemed to be covered with blood. The enemy's eyes were nearly closed, and the body, wherever the remains of Weston's shirt did not conceal it, was a mass of what would soon be bruises. This, and its laboured breathing, and the very taste of its strength in their grapples, had altered Ransom's state of mind completely. He had been astonished to find it no stronger. He had all along, despite what reason told him, expected that the strength of its body would be superhuman, diabolical. He had reckoned on arms that could no more be caught and stopped than the blades of an aeroplane's propeller. But now he knew, by actual experience, that its bodily strength was merely that of Weston. On the physical plane, it was one middle-aged scholar against another. Weston had been the more powerfully built of the two men, but he was fat. His body would not take punishment well. Ransom was nimbler and better breathed. His former certainty of death now seemed to him ridiculous. It was a very fair match. There was no reason why he should not win and live. This time it was Ransom who attacked, and the second bout was much the same as the first. What it came to was that whenever he could box, Ransom was superior. Whenever he came under tooth and claw, he was beaten. His mind, even in the thick of it, was now quite clear. He saw that the issue of the day hung on a very simple question, whether loss of blood would undo him before heavy blows on heart and kidneys undid the other. All that rich world was asleep about them. There were no rules, no umpire, no spectators, but mere exhaustion, constantly compelling them to fall apart, divided the grotesque duel into rounds as accurately as could be wished. Ransom could never remember how many of these rounds were fought. The thing became like the frantic repetitions of delirium, and thirst a greater pain than any the adversary could inflict. Sometimes they were both on the ground together. Once he was actually astride the enemy's chest, squeezing its throat with both hands, and, he found to his surprise, shouting a line out of the Battle of Maldon. But it tore his arm so with its nails, and so pounded his back with its knees, that he was thrown off. Then he remembers, as one remembers an island of consciousness preceded and followed by long anaesthesia, going forward to meet the unman for what seemed the thousandth time, and knowing clearly that he could not fight much more. He remembers seeing the enemy for a moment looking not like Weston, but like a mandrill, and realizing almost at once that this was delirium. He wavered. Then an experience that perhaps no good man can ever have in our world came over him, a torrent of perfectly unmixed and lawful hatred. The energy of hating, never before felt without some guilt, without some dim knowledge that he was failing fully to distinguish the sinner from the sin, rose into his arms and legs till he felt that they were pillars of burning blood. What was before him appeared no longer a creature of corrupted will. It was corruption itself to which will was attached only as an instrument. Ages ago it had been a person, but the ruins of personality now survived in it only as weapons at the disposal of a furious, self-exiled negation. It is perhaps difficult to understand why this filled Ransom not with horror, but with a kind of joy. The joy came from finding at last what hatred was made for. As a boy with an axe rejoices on finding a tree, or a boy with a box of coloured chalks rejoices on finding a pile of perfectly white paper, so he rejoiced in the perfect congruity between his emotion and its object. Bleeding and trembling with weariness as he was, he felt that nothing was beyond his power. And when he flung himself upon the living death, the eternal surd in the universal mathematic, he was astonished, and yet, on a deeper level, not astonished at all at his own strength. His arms seemed to move quicker than his thought. His hands taught him terrible things. He felt its ribs break. He heard its jawbone crack. The whole creature seemed to be crackling and splitting under his blows. His own pains, where it tore him, somehow failed to matter. He felt that he could so fight, so hate with a perfect hatred for a whole year. All at once he found he was beating the air. He was in such a state that at first he could not understand what was happening, could not believe that the unman had fled. His momentary stupidity gave it a start, and when he came to his senses he was just in time to see it vanishing into the wood with a limping, uneven stride, with one arm hanging useless and with its dog-like howl. He dashed after it. For a second or so it was concealed from him by the tree trunks. Then it was once more in sight. He began running with all his power, but it kept its lead. It was a fantastic chase, in and out of the lights and shadows, and up and down the slowly moving ridges and valleys. They passed the dragon where it slept. They passed the lady, sleeping with a smile on her face. The unman stooped low as it passed her, with the fingers of its left hand crooked for scratching. It would have torn her if it dared, but Ransom was close behind, and it could not risk the delay. They passed through a flock of large orange-coloured birds, all fast asleep, each on one leg, each with its head beneath its wing, so that they looked like a grove of formal and flowery shrubs. They picked their steps where pairs and families of the yellow wallabies lay on their backs, with eyes fast shut and their small forepaws folded on their breasts, as if they were crusaders carved on tombs. They stooped beneath branches which were bowed down, because on them lay the tree pigs, making a comfortable noise like a child's snore. They crashed through thickets of bubble trees and forgot, for the moment, their weariness. It was a large island. They came out of the woods and rushed across wide fields of saffron or of silver, sometimes deep to their ankles and sometimes to their waists in the cool or poignant sense. They rushed down into yet another woods which lay, as they approached them, at the bottom of secret valleys, but rose before they reached them to crown the summits of lonely hills. Ransom could not gain on his quarry. It was a wonder that any creature so maimed as its uneven strides showed it to be could maintain that pace. If the ankle were really sprained, as he suspected, it must suffer indescribably at every step. Then the horrible thought came into his mind that perhaps it could somehow hand over the pain, to be borne by whatever remnants of Weston's consciousness yet survived in its body. The idea that something which had once been of his own kind and fed at a human breast might even now be imprisoned in the thing he was pursuing redoubled his hatred, which was unlike nearly all other hatreds he had ever known, for it increased his strength. As they emerged from about the fourth wood, he saw the sea before them, not 30 yards away. The unman rushed on as if it made no distinction between land and water, and plunged in with a great splash. He could see its head, dark against the coppery sea, as it swam. Ransom rejoiced, for swimming was the only sport in which he had ever approached excellence. As he took the water, he lost sight of the unman for a moment. Then, looking up and shaking the wet hair from his face as he struck out in pursuit, his hair was very long by now, he saw its whole body upright and above the surface, as though it were sitting on the sea. A second glance, and he realized that it had mounted a fish. Apparently the charmed slumber extended only to the island, for the unman on his mount was making good speed. It was stooping down, doing something to its fish. Ransom could not see what. Doubtless it would have many ways of urging the animal to quicken its pace. For a moment he was in despair, but he had forgotten the man-loving nature of these seahorses. He found almost at once that he was in a complete shoal of the creatures, leaping and frisking to attract his attention. In spite of their good will, it was no easy matter to get himself onto the slippery surface of the fine specimen which his grabbing hands first reached. While he was struggling to mount, the distance widened between him and the fugitive. But at last it was done. Settling himself behind the great goggle-eyed head, he nudged the animal with his knees, kicked it with his heels, whispered words of praise and encouragement, and in general did all he could to awake its mettle. It began threshing its way forward. But looking ahead, Ransom could no longer see any sign of the unman, but only the long, empty ridge of the next wave coming towards him. Doubtless the quarry was beyond the ridge. Then he noticed that he had no cause to be bothered about the direction. The slope of water was dotted all over with the great fish, each marked by a heap of yellow foam, and some of them spouting as well. The unman possibly had not reckoned on the instinct which made them follow as leader any of their company on whom a human being sat. They were all forging straight ahead, no more uncertain of their course than homing rooks or bloodhounds on a scent. As Ransom and his fish rose to the top of the wave, he found himself looking down on a wide, shallow trough, shaped much like a valley in the home counties. Far away, and now approaching the opposite slope, was the little, dark, puppet-like silhouette of the unman. And between it and him, the whole school of fish was spread out in 3 or 4 lines. Clearly there was no danger of losing touch. Ransom was hunting him with the fish, and they would not cease to follow. He laughed aloud. "My hounds are bred out of the Spartan kind, so flued, so sanded," he roared. Now, for the first time, the blessed fact that he was no longer fighting, nor even standing, thrust itself upon his attention. He made to assume a more relaxed position, and was pulled up sharp by a grinding pain across his back. He foolishly put back his hand to explore his shoulders, and almost screamed at the pain of his own touch. His back seemed to be in shreds, and the shreds seemed to be all stuck together. At the same time he noticed that he had lost a tooth, and that nearly all the skin was gone from his knuckles. And underneath the smarting surface pains, deeper and more ominous aches racked him from head to foot. He had not known he was so knocked up. Then he remembered that he was thirsty. Now that he had begun to cool and stiffen, he found the task of getting a drink from the water that raced by him extremely difficult. His first idea had been to stoop low till his head was almost upside down and bury his face in the water. But a single attempt cured him of that. He was reduced to putting down his cupped hands, and even this, as his stiffness grew upon him, had to be done with infinite caution and with many groans and gasps. It took many minutes to get a tiny sip which merely mocked his thirst. The quenching of that thirst kept him employed for what seemed to be half an hour, a half hour of sharp pains and insane pleasures. Nothing had ever tasted so good. Even when he had done drinking, he went on taking up water and splashing it over himself. This would have been among the happiest moments of his life, if only the smarting of his back did not seem to be getting worse, and if only he were not afraid that there was poison in the cuts. His legs kept on getting stuck to the fish and having to be unstuck with pain and care. Every now and then blackness threatened to come over him. He could easily have fainted, but he thought, "This will never do," and fixed his eyes on objects close at hand and thought plain thoughts, and so retained his consciousness. All this time the unman rode on before him, upwave and downwave, and the fishes followed and Ransom followed the fishes. There seemed to be more of them now, as if the chase had met other shoals and gathered them up into itself in snowball fashion. And soon there were creatures other than fish, birds with long necks like swans. He could not tell their colour, for they looked black against the sky, came wheeling at first overhead, but afterwards they settled in long, straight files, all following the unman. The crying of these birds was often audible, and it was the wildest sound that Ransom had ever heard, the loneliest and the one that had least to do with man. No land was in sight, nor had been for many hours. He was on the high seas, the waste places of Perelandra, as he had not been since his first arrival. The sea noises continuously filled his ear. The sea smell, unmistakable and stirring as that of our Tellurian oceans, but quite different in its warmth and golden sweetness, entered into his brain. It also was wild and strange. It was not hostile. If it had been, its wildness and strangeness would have been the less, for hostility is a relation, and an enemy is not a total stranger. It came into his head that he knew nothing at all about this world. Some day, no doubt, it would be peopled by the descendants of the king and queen. But all its millions of years in the unpeopled past, all its uncounted miles of laughing water in the lonely present, did they exist solely for that? It was strange that he, to whom a wood or a morning sky on earth had sometimes been a kind of meal, should have had to come to another planet in order to realize nature as a thing in her own right. The diffused meaning, the inscrutable character, which had been both in Tellus and Perelandra since they split off from the sun, and which would be, in one sense, displaced by the advent of imperial man, yet, in some other sense, not displaced at all, enfolded him on every side and caught him into itself.